Hello, 안녕하세요. Welcome to the latest episode of the North Korea podcast, now in partnership with The Diplomat, the world's leading news source for Asian affairs. This is a podcast where we look over the 38th parallel and into the world's most secretive, intriguing, and to many the most frightening country on the planet. Why does a small country of 25 million people matter and so often dominate the headlines? Well, this week we are going to talk to Robert Boynton, the author of the new book, The Invitation Only Zone, the true story of North Korea's abduction project. This is a fascinating insight into the abduction of Japanese citizens directly from Japan by North Korea in the 70s and 80s. We're also going to talk to Robin Tudge, who has just come back from running the Pyongyang Marathon, which for the last few years has been open to foreigners who wish to take part. But before all that, we're going to talk to our reporter, Simon Harris, who has been keeping an eye on media developments in the North.
It's the 6th of May. That's the date of the 7th Party Congress. Media watchers have been waiting for this date for months. The Party Congress is a big deal in the DPRK. The last one was in October 1980, before the current leader was even born. It lasted 4 days and it's a platform to announce new policy and ideas and a direction for the country. And in 1980, it confirmed Kim Jong-il as his father's successor. Professor Kim Dong-yuk from Dongyuk University.
The degree of personal reshuffling within the party will be closely watched, as well as how Kim presents his pursuit of Pyongjin policy of simultaneous nuclear and economic development.
The gathering, which will take place in the capital from the 6th of May, will only be the 7th in the party's history and the first under the current leader. The statement from North Korea's news agency, the KCNA, gave no details of the event and did not specify how long it would last. But it is widely expected that Mr. Kim will use the gathering to both reinforce his role as supreme leader and to push his agenda of economic development coupled with nuclear progress.
That was Simon Harris on the upcoming Congress on the 6th of May. That is going to be absolutely fascinating if you consider that not even Kim Jong-il ever held a Congress in his time as leader. And there is going to be a new image perhaps developed from Kim Jong-un about how he wants the future of North Korea to develop. But moving on now to this week's guest, we have Robert Boynton, who is the author of a new book called The Invitation Only Zone, the true story of North Korea's abduction project from Japan. This is an absolutely fascinating read, and Robert Boynton has been researching the issue of literally abductions from Japan by North Koreans in the 70s and 80s. I spoke to him. He told me, first of all, a bit of background about what these abductions are and how many took place.
The abduction project has a very long history in North Korea. The focus of my book is the Japanese abductees who were taken from coastal towns and cities in Japan in the late 1970s. There were abductions, earlier phases of the abductions, where South Korean fishermen were abducted in the 60s and 70s. There were people abducted from other parts of the world as well. But the idea behind the Japanese phase of the abduction was to, believe it or not, to get Japanese who would perhaps spy on behalf of the North Korean state. And if they wouldn't do that, then at the very least they would train North Korean spies to pass as Japanese by giving them linguistic and cultural training, having, you know, come from Japan right then in 1977.
How many people in total, do we have a figure of how many people were abducted actually from Japan?
The numbers are very hard to nail down. The Japanese government recognizes 17 abductees. The North Korean government recognizes 13 abductees, and there have been some estimations that it can run anywhere into several hundred.
And they were of mixed ages, presumably?
Yes, they were. The ones among the 17 who have been identified by the Japanese government, they were fairly young. I think the oldest was in the 40s or something like that, but they tend to be younger people, yes.
And can you tell us, Robert, more about the lives the abductees lived when they were in and off? So they have come from Japan. They've obviously had a terribly traumatic experience. They've ended up in North Korea. What happened to them next?
Well, the North Koreans had devised a very effective scheme whereby they would try to abduct people in couples. They would separate the two within the couple and tell each of the man and the woman that the other one had been left behind. Then they would embark on about 18 months, 2 years of language and ideological training, where they would be taught Korean, they would be taught about the Juche philosophy, the state philosophy of North Korea, and generally educated along the lines of North Korean regime. Then they would be brought back together, told, oh, actually, your girlfriend, boyfriend, wife, husband is actually here, and would you like to meet them? And inevitably, a number of the couples ended up getting married. And the reason for this sort of this odd arrangement was that they wanted to bring them to the brink of helplessness, to the point where they felt there was really no one who could understand what they were going through, who could, who they could collaborate with or fight back with, and then at that point bring them someone else that would really keep them from falling to the depths of despair. And this worked very well.
And were they treated well within the North?
The life they lived in North Korea was, by North Korean standards, fairly good. It's safe to say they lived better lives. They had more access to food, shelter, things like that than the typical North Koreans, which is not to say that they were well treated by Japanese terms, but sometimes people think that they were kept in these sort of gulags that North Korea has become infamous for, but this is not the case. They were in these invitation-only zones that were essentially guarded communities, gated communities. And these gated communities were not created for the abductees specifically. They were created for any North Koreans who had access to information that the North Korean state did not want being disseminated among ordinary North Koreans. So these were spies, translators, some diplomats, people like that. So the abductees fell into that group.
And going back a bit, physically, how were these abductees taken from? I imagine it's quite difficult to take an abductee from a country and physically take them to another, especially when you're from the world's most secretive state.
It was, there's a spectrum. It was everything from the most brutal abduction, such as the case in Hasuike Karu, where he and his girlfriend were, you know, attacked on a beach, taped, had their hands and feet bound, their mouths taped, thrown into sacks that they zipped up, put into a dinghy, and the dinghy went out about an hour's trip to a larger boat, which then took them back to North Korea. The boats were posing as fishing boats so that they could blend in with the other Japanese boats. On the other end of the spectrum, some of the abductions really amounted more to luring someone with either a free trip, or in one case, an artist was offered an exhibition or a very well-paying job, and then not letting them go.
And can you tell us any particular person? You obviously research all of these cases. Was there any one case which really struck you in terms of being extremely heartfelt for you?
Well, the best known case, and really in some sense the most tragic one, is a 13-year-old girl named Yokota Megumi, who was taken from Niigata, from just down the street from her parents' house. And she was abducted in 1977. And, you know, got to North Korea. I think the North Koreans hadn't realized they were taking such a young girl. She eventually was married to a South Korean abductee. They had a child. And the North Koreans report that she committed suicide. The Japanese don't accept that account. But she really, I think, in some ways had her, you know, her whole childhood, her whole life stolen from her. And in many ways is the most tragic of those stories.
And you talk about the wider context of something which is still relevant today about Korea-Japan relations and almost hatred which is felt of Japan. And as someone who has lived in South Korea, the really is still today a very passionate, in some sense, a dislike towards Japan. How much do you think that exists today, even in the South?
Well, I think there, you know, the extensive, you know, hatred or dislike between South Korea and the Japanese, or the Koreans and the Japanese, is something that sort of, you know, gets worse and gets better over time. Right now, I think it's not particularly good. situation. But I think there have been plenty of times over the course of certainly the last 40, 50 years where relations have been better. I mean, the fact is that until quite recently, the largest number of tourists to visit Japan came from South Korea. The largest number of tourists to visit South Korea came from Japan. I'm not saying that that undercuts completely the animosity, but it does say something.
Kim Jong-il pretty much admitted a rare admission from North Korea that it had actually taken the abductees. And can you tell us about the reaction in Japan today about this issue?
Yes, well, there had been a long series of negotiations between negotiators for Prime Minister Koizumi in Japan and Kim Jong-il in North Korea, which led to a summit in Pyongyang and the signing of the what's called the Pyongyang Declaration. One of the conditions for the summit was that Kim Jong-il had to admit in some fashion to the abductions and had to release the ones who remained and things like that. The thought on both sides was that this would put to rest the abduction issue, that the rumors which have been circulating in Japan would finally be put to rest and the two countries could proceed along the path of reconciling their relations, establishing diplomatic relations. The result was completely the opposite from what anyone thought. It actually, the Japanese public was aghast. I compare it to being told that, say, the accounts you've been reading in magazines, newspapers about the alien abduction actually were true. This was sort of the head-snapping moment for the Japanese public. And it was a double betrayal because on the one hand, they felt that the Japanese government hadn't protected them. You know, this very paternalistic government, which had they had given up, made all sorts of compromises with in exchange for safety, had not done that. And it turned out that a number of Japanese officials in the government had known about the abductions even before they came out, even while they were taking place and had done nothing. So there was this sort of double sense of betrayal among the Japanese. And finally, just this sense that, oh my God, North Korea is really a much more dangerous place than we thought it was.
North Korea says that no abductees are still alive, if I'm right in saying.
Correct.
I believe there's widespread suspicion in Japan about this. Robert, you've been researching this issue in depth. Do you think any of these abductees are still alive?
Nobody really knows anything. I have to say, having done several years of interviews, that I would be very surprised if there weren't some Japanese citizens who were in North Korea against their will. I don't know if the particular abductees that are on the list of 17 that the Japanese have accumulated are alive or not, but I've run into enough people over the years to know that there were a lot of Japanese who were one way or another found their way to North Korea and who couldn't get out, and I'd be surprised if some of them weren't still alive.
And those Japanese abductees who did end up returning back to Japan, they must have had almost reverse culture shock, right? Surely they've lived in North Korea for so long. What is the state of them today?
Well, they had lived, these are people, young people for the most part, they were in their, in their early 20s. They spent more years in North Korea than they had in Japan, 24 in North Korea, say 21 in Japan. So, the culture shock was considerable, as you say. They had been in a position, an odd position of sort of monitoring the outside world by their roles as translators. They would translate large amounts of Japanese newspapers, magazines, and other things for the ruling elite within North Korea that wanted to have, sort of, that had access to these sort of sources of information. So it wasn't as if they didn't know what had been happening in the outside world. They had a pretty good, perhaps a better idea than pretty much almost anyone else in North Korea. So it wasn't as if they were shocked that, certain inventions had taken place or certain things had happened. But that said, the kind of cultural shock of stepping back into a society that that formed you was considerable. If anyone knows anything about Japanese culture, you are very much defined by the group you inhabit, whether it's your graduating class in university or the class that enters the corporation together. And these are people who've been completely out of step for 24 years.
And the question I'm burning to ask is, did any of these abductees, and I know they went through a traumatic experience and were taken against their will, but Did any of them actually end up enjoying life in North Korea, or was it just a constant burden for them during the whole many years they were there?
That's a very sensitive subject, and one that I actually explored with some of the abductees, because it was, a reasonable question. I mean, those who didn't commit suicide or sort of fall into despair put themselves together, got married, had children, they had lives, and certainly not the lives they would have chosen, but within that life, I was very curious about what the sort of quotidian day-to-day was like and whether there was some enjoyment. They loved their children dearly and got a lot of pleasure and a lot of satisfaction out of raising them. The children really became the sort of main project of their existence. So I would say in that respect, yes, I think they did. Enjoy is such a loaded word, but I think that they did derive some satisfaction from their lives. Obviously a great deal less satisfaction than had those lives been lived in Japan with their families.
How serious is this issue for future diplomatic relations between Japan and North Korea?
It's a very serious issue. It's a real stumbling block for any kind of negotiation. It's hard in the midst of sanctions and things like that that are going on right now to really even see a path for any sorts of negotiations. But it is something that has sort of stuck in the craw of the Japanese public and the Japanese government. I don't think that there's any possibility of Japan signing on to a larger denuclearization agreement or some sort of thing without this being dealt with in some fashion. So it's a relatively unknown or little known episode, but it has some very big implications, because if you try to establish peace in Northeast Asia between China, the Koreas, and Japan, and Japan won't play, you're in big trouble.
And you can buy Robert Boynton's book, which is available in bookshops and online. Of course, you can download it from Amazon. It is called The Invitation Only Zone, North Korea's Secret Abduction Project, and is published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. I have to say, it is an absolutely fascinating read. Certainly one of the best on North Korea in recent times, and I would argue one of the most significant. I would definitely encourage you. It was a fantastic, fantastic read, and I enjoyed it anyway. You can follow Robert on Twitter at RSBoynton. You can also follow the podcast on iTunes and Podcast Machine. Any reviews, for good or bad, are much welcome. We're on Twitter at the NK Podcast, and we're now in partnership with The Diplomat. So moving on to the Pyongyang Marathon. This year, Robin Tudge, who is from England, decided he was going to run alongside 1,000 other foreign runners the arguably the world's most exclusive marathon. Now, Robert calls himself an amateur, although he did this in a time which, even if I trained for years and years and years, I wouldn't even get close to, but he still maintains that it wasn't a very good time. Decided this year he was going to go to Pyongyang and run through the streets. The course is sort of a freeway loop, so it's not just 126 miles. And I spoke to him more as to what attracted him to actually go and do a marathon in Pyongyang.
They've had an international marathon for a few decades now, but it was only in 2014 that they opened it up to amateurs. And I thought, well, I obviously qualify as that. And by that point, I'd already led a few tours into North Korea. And I thought, well, why wouldn't you want to do it? I mean, if you're going to run marathons, and the whole sort of thing of marathons is running in these cities all over the world, and it's the adventure and the destination, and then you get there. I mean, Pyongyang is a kind of, the next, if not the last, frontier where you can do this sort of thing.
And was it a hard course? Were there many hills? And did the crowds help spur you on?
Wasn't the hardest of course. I mean, there was a couple of sort of quite sharp hills on the roads, but for the most part, it was pretty flat. I mean, there's a 10-kilometer loop, which you do as many times as you need to in order to fill out a half marathon or a full marathon. I did a half marathon. It was lined all along with people. It was extraordinary that the number of people you could actually get to do high fives. And it became almost a game where you'd see in the distance, say, 20 or 25 people lined up, and it'd be everybody and anybody from little children to grannies to people in uniform. And you'd start at one end with your hand out and just sort of clatter along it.
The crowd were very supportive of you.
Yeah, no, they were lovely. I mean, they were cheering us along and seemed to be really enjoying it. And often as not, I mean, we were allowed to take pictures pretty much all along the route. And so, a lot of people ended up with times which are far worse than they would have expected, because they just got so absorbed with taking pictures and sort of trying to banter as much as you can with the crowd. You'd have kids and you'd want to take pictures and they could as easily sort of run away. So you have to take that into account and not chase them down if they didn't want it. But it was, it was a kind of unique opportunity, really, just to sort of, notwithstanding the fact that you are kind of technically running, to just sort of stop and chat as much as you could, or mingle as much as you could, or just sort of say hello.
And the big city marathons are famous for people running in fancy dress. I have to confess myself to once doing a half marathon dressed as Sonic the Hedgehog. Were there any wacky costumes or anything like that?
The short answer is absolutely not. I mean, that there were also, it's true to say that there were restrictions as to what you could sort of run in. I mean, certainly not any costumes, no real major logos. I mean, you could wear a T-shirt with a small sort of swoosh, say, or a very small logo on it, but nothing, no big type, no big print. It was as plain as, really. I mean, I was running it for charity. I was running it for Arthritis UK, Arthritis Research UK, rather. And I had transfers, sort of large A's, that I could stick on my face. I mean, that was all right, but really nothing else beyond that.
You say you're an amateur, but I'm suspicious. Could you just tell us, I know the winning time for a man is about 2 hours, 10 minutes of a normal marathon, if I'm right. What was your time then, Robin?
Well, for the half marathon, it was 2 hours, 39.
Right.
I was aiming, in theory, I should have done under 2 hours, but I spent so much time taking pictures. By the end of it, I was so dehydrated as well from... I mean, I hadn't really done any training. I'd had about 5 pints the night before. I'd had about 10 pints 3 days before when I arrived in Beijing because I was meeting up with all the guides. You know, got jet lag, got everything on top.
Great. So you finished, I believe, in the May the First Stadium.
Yes.
How can you tell us, was that full? And could you just tell us about that experience?
Well, the finish wasn't so much. It was more actually the entrance, because I think in total there's 1,100 international athletes, professional and amateur. And we were brought into the stadium through the sort of athlete's tunnel, which, you know, athletes, footballers do. You see them coming out and everybody cheers and hoorays. When you're actually in such a throng, it's quite extraordinary. When you're in amid such a throng in the middle of Pyongyang, of all places, it's kind of mind-blowing. And into the Mayday Stadium, which is, I think, one of the world's largest stadiums. It has a capacity at least of 150,000 seats, of which at least half were full. And as we walk out of this sort of darkened tunnel into this sunlight and this great sort of brass band fanfare, and literally tens of thousands of North Koreans cheering. It was just incredible. And as you're sort of doing the warm-up lap and you're kind of lining up for the sort of opening ceremony speech, etc., etc., and you're running past the crowds and you stop and you raise your arms trying to get them to a Mexican wave, they won't do that, but they all cheer. And you raise your arms again and they cheer loud, and you raise them again and they cheer all the louder. And there was just this remarkable sense of connection.
And did you notice any signs around Pyongyang as you run around the whole city? Were there any signs, any propaganda, or was there anything which really struck you?
Stuff that might strike other people as sort of unusual, quintessentially Pyongyang or North Korea, to me, are kind of somewhat more for the norm. That said, nothing really jumped out. I mean, there are some sort of propaganda posters or inspirational posters, that what you will, with regard to the forthcoming Congress. But beyond that, nothing particularly unusual. But there were just people lining the street applauding us all the way. And it was really lovely to be part of.
And what was the most memorable moment of this Pyongyang marathon for you, Robin?
The thing that, you know, I'm going to replay again and again will be the entrance to the stadium, you know, and just the cheering and getting the crowds to cheer in that way. And I know it's just an occasion of such kind of enormity. I mean, the excitement we had in the tunnel anyway, everybody would have, is the kind of excitement you'd naturally have sort of before a race of any kind. But it was just so... Nobody really knew what to expect. And then when finally you're there, just in this sort of huge cold air of cheering people of all the places, it was absolutely incredible.
Did you run past any of the big statues of the Kims?
Not that I recall, no. I mean, the main statues in Pyongyang are the grand statues on Mansu Hill. Obviously, that's of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. And we didn't pass that. That wasn't on the loop. We went, the main monument, as far as I recall, was the Arch of Triumph. And that was sort of... And obviously the Mayday Stadium itself, but the statues were within sight, but we didn't run past them directly. No.
And is this marathon, has it got IAAF approval? Is there any? Is the course, you know, is the course length verified? Are there doping tests for the winners? Is there proper timekeeping?
There's certainly proper timekeeping. I don't know about doping tests. So I'd assume it's all held under the sort of proper rigors and aegis of the IAAF, because it is an IAAF approved event. I mean, the course itself was certainly interesting. I mean, I suppose one distinction you could say with other marathons in other cities is they have a beginning and an end, and it's 26 miles in between, and it's one long, great big thread. With Pyongyang, there's obviously the limit that it is a 10K circuit done however many times you need to do it. So there's a kind of restriction there. So one of the things with North Korea is sort of every step towards opening up, it's always within very tight parameters. So it's one step, not quite one step forward, one step back. It's kind of one step forward, but more of the same, if you see what I mean.
You're an alien. You've come to Earth. You've got to persuade the alien to do the Pyongyang marathon ahead of any other marathon in any other city. Can you give them a good reason why the Pyongyang marathon is better than marathons in other cities?
Because it's still so early and new and fresh, it's still, as far as I can see, just maybe I'm contradicting myself, but it's so far as I'm concerned, it's just incredibly unique. And for the whole experience, you know, starting with the May Day Stadium and just being able to run through a city like Pyongyang at all and have, for the first time, just that slither of sort of relative freedom to engage with people as far as you can or as far as are allowed. And by that, in any case, you will be in the company, as said, of other international marathon runners who will be able to point you to other sort of events all the way around the world. But I think if you're going to really start, if you're going to come down to earth for the first time and thinking, oh, I think I'll take out marathon running, I think Pyongyang would be one hell of a place to start.
And that was Robin Tudge's rather energetic views on the Pyongyang marathon. Fantastic insight there. So now you can follow us on Twitter at the NK Podcast. We're on iTunes. You can leave a review there. Do subscribe. And any comments are always appreciated for good or bad. So every week we ask our main guest the same three questions. So this time I asked Robert Boynton whether he thinks North Korea will ever collapse.
I think the possibility of a North Korean collapse is very, very low. I think that the kind of, if you were to call it a collapse, a kind of sort of confederation with either China or South Korea is much more likely.
Do you think Korea will ever reunify?
I think there will be some kind of reunification, but it will not be a sort of borderless open state where you all of a sudden have, not 25 and 50 million, but 75 million people, be able to travel back and forth.
Can you tell me the craziest story you've ever come across from your time researching North Korea?
I think the craziest story I ever heard was, at one point the abductees were, these are Japanese who were posing as North Koreans, who were translating Japanese documents in North Korean, were being paid in American dollars, which they would then trade for North Korean won to then go into the stores and buy French perfume and shampoo with. So this kind of upside-down United Nations world of abduction, I think, was one of the strangest thing I've ever heard.
Feel free to leave a comment or review. They're always appreciated, for good or bad. Thank you very much for listening. 감사합니다. 안녕히 계세요.